Chapter 27. Intent to Fail. The Dachshund drifted over the streets of Wiselton like a circling vulture, except that, unlike the vulture, it killed its own prey before feasting. The initial attack had included a sweep of the city gates, and Jinzan had left some of his apprentices by each to hold them against the anticipated stampede of frightened peasants. Jinzan stood at the ship's bow, leaning out and over the edge to catch sight of fleeing cadrans and draw out their sources. It was a harvest more than an assault, a recruitment effort for an army that conscripted even children and the infirm. Jinzan ached from the passing of such vast amounts of ether through his own source, even with the aid of the staff of Galen.
"Bring us hard about," Jinzan rasped.
He spoke seldom enough that his voice was growing stale from disuse. He had no need to speak the orders aloud. His crew of dead cadrans did not understand Magrin anyway, and obeyed the thoughts behind the words.
"Prepare for another pass, by the eastern gate."
A mumbling gibberish of arcane words from the ship's dead sorcerer resulted in a tailwind along their new course.
"Cannot even speak the spell properly, but they can work their magics anyway. I must teach a new one, though. Perhaps one of the apprentices. That cadran corpse will not last much longer."
The rigging pulled taut, and a creak of protesting timbers accompanied their turn.
"Master, look to the south!"
One of the few remaining apprentices aboard had called out above the winds and screams from the terrified and dying below.
"Master, you call me? I should be captain here. And that is starboard on a ship, you land-dwelling clod. It is even south-southwest, if you must use compass points."
Jinzan's mental rant passed quickly as he deigned to heed the ill-worded warning. There was another airship approaching.
"Belay my previous order," Jinzan said,
voice hardly strong enough to carry over the ambient aeronautical noise, barely more than a hoarse whisper.
"Mr. Holyoke, run out the guns!"
Of course, there were no cannon aboard the Cadran ship, and only a few twinborn who would even know what to do with such an order. Just seeing an enemy ship, though, was enough to spark memories of happier times in another world, in a sea made of water instead of air. The ship changed headings yet again, swerving and waggling in the air until the crew had sorted them out on a course to pass the rival airship. The captain of the other vessel seemed of like mind, and the two ships came together like jousters on the tournament ground. Jinzan kept his position at the bow, growing nervous that the ships might collide, so close did their headings appear.
"Would they ram us? Near certain death for all on both sides."
Jinzan had the Dachshund turn a few degrees to port at the last moment. Jinzan held the staff of Galen out, reaching to grasp the sources aboard the Cadran ship. Accustomed to far different battles at sea, he found himself astonished at the speed with which the two ships passed. He had nothing like the time needed to wrench free the mortal ether within his victims. Jinzan turned to watch the Cadran ship recede in his view, but noticed something else more urgent. The other ship's sorcerer had been better prepared for a brief pass. Flames ate at the Dachshund's rigging and sails, where a spread of firebolts must have struck them. The dead crew carried on, oblivious. The apprentices had no ready answer either, looking to their master for succor. Jinzan struggled a moment to flip through the catalog of old spells he knew, things he knew before the wonders of Lorimar's magic had supplanted them. The Grand Necromancer's cache of wisdom held such elegant simplicity, power beyond imagining, written in primal snips of what must have been the language the gods used in creating men. The old, tired ways of his academy learning felt childish by comparison, but dealt with matters of elemental energy and materials, problems closer at hand than the loftier study of immortality.
"Pukai Feldinak Ixnoi," Jinzan whispered.
He watched the fires, reaching out to each and pinching his fingers. One by one, they snuffed out. He felt a smile within him that settled among the muscles of his face.
"Full about," he ordered,
chuckling with a dry wheeze as the crew struggled with the damaged rigging, ropes snapped and dangling loose in places. The Dakun protested, but obeyed. The Kadrin ship had already turned about, nimbler in the air with a living crew and undamaged ship.
You wish to fight with fire, then? Very well.
Jinzan watched the ships hurtling toward one another once more, and tried to gauge his timing. It was a blunt calculation, more to ease the tax upon his source than any real limit to the power the staff bestowed upon him. He was more greatly concerned about being late than early, and he had plenty of ether stored for what he had planned.
Omiku, Draxo, Tojifu, Ratakinu, Hakto,
Jinzan shouted, lending all the voice he had in his anger. He raised his arms high in the air, beckoning the bowels of the earth to issue forth his wrath. The ground below cracked and parted. A great gout of molten rock erupted from the streets of Wiselton, directly in the path of the Kadrin ship. The Dakun swung about in an effort to avoid the spattering fires and bits of melted stone that splashed around the pillar of destruction. The Kadrin ship had no time to react. It was a smoking, fiery hulk of timbers the instant it hit the volcanic mass in its path. It crashed into the city, spreading fires among the buildings that promised to put half the city to flames. The ship's sudden turn had put Jinzan grasping for the safety of the riggings, despite not just anticipating it but having given the order. The spell had drained him more than he had expected. He stumbled across the deck to the nearest crewman and sucked the dead man's source dry. The corpse collapsed, inanimate once more. Jinzan felt better immediately. The spell he had used was not from Lorimar's tomb, nor anything he had been taught at the academy. Rather, it was a spell that proper young students ought never to have seen. It was, however, the type of spell that an ambitious and talented young Magrin patriot would seek out, even if he found it beyond his power at the time. Jinzan scanned the skies, watching as they filled with smoke and seeking signs of any other aerial opposition. Finding none, he resumed his work of harvesting an army of the dead. It was a coward's run, headlong, panting for breath, with nary a thought backward except to verify that life-ending peril was indeed still at hand. Each glance over his shoulder showed Theron Lurien sights he had hoped he would never see.
His pursuers were dead, garishly, sloppily, freshly dead.
They still wore Kadrin uniforms and wielded Kadrin-issued spears. The nearest to him, which he saw all too clearly each time he turned, bore claw-like scratches down its face and an eye that had been torn loose but not off. Eight of them had fled the walls of Wiselton. Seven made it as far as the first farms tucked in between the city and the forest. Five still ran as they stumbled through the underbrush. Theron spared just enough time to fumble at his belt for a pouch that held a palm-sized turtle shell. The markings on it were faded red paint, chipped and flaking, but the runes were whole enough. He held it with both hands and blew a ragged gasp through it as he kept his legs scrambling beneath him. The shell let forth a sound like a sheep trying to bleat out a tavern song. A few paces further along, Theron slowed and tried again. The painted runes glowed.
Brew!
He did not bother to stow the magical horn, but neither did he drop it. Theron gained some measure of hope as he saw the undead soldiers struggling with the gnarled and root-clutched forest floor. Never did they end their chase, but each pratfall gained the weary refugees precious distance. A thrashing in the forest ahead gave pause to four of the runners, but Theron's heart leapt.
"Help us, please!" he called out.
Voice, hoarse, but available on limited muster. He spoke not his own tongue, nor any other human language, but that of the ogres who called the forest their land. Mammoth humanoids emerged, their painted skins blending them in against the forestscape until they were just a few paces distant. Like men stretched and pulled, they bore a human shape, if not one most folk would consider pretty. Gaunt and muscular, Their ribs showed where hair and sinew did not cover them. Their skulls were wider and rounder than those of humans. The warm season kept them clad in little more than rags that dangled about their waistlines, and a few trinkets worn as decoration. Their weapons were carved tree trunks, shaped with likenesses of fearsome beasts, both real and fantastical. There were handholds cut in the titanic clubs, meant to be wielded with both hands by creatures strong enough to crush a man's skull between pinched fingers. The other Kadrin refugees cried out in terror, but Theron shouted them a warning.
Get down!
Frightened and confused, the others obeyed, diving headlong into the brush before the onrushing ogres. A score or more dead soldiers outnumbered the three ogres who came to Theron's call, but numbers had never been the ogres' worry. The dead flew in pieces from the ogres' sweeping swings, battering rams whipping through the air like swords. If any Kadrin among them had been trained in tactics against ogres, the knowledge seemed not to have persisted beyond death. Theron helped put fire to the twitching legs, arms, and heads, which gamely kept trying to fight even when separated from their bodies. The ogres accepted the aid of the Kadrin sorcerer without a word. When he was finished, and the piled remains lay still and smoldering, the ogres took over. They laid aside their weapons and knelt. With calloused hands twice the size of a man's foot, they patted the earth, occasionally pausing to spit. They were either cleansing the land or trying to protect it against the spread of fire. Theron did not know which.
Thank you, Theron told the eldest among them, after the ogres finished their task and stood.
You gave your word, the elder ogre said.
He took hold of a string of beads that dangled from his waist, held it toward Theron and shook it.
4 and 10 times the moon has filled and emptied. You kept your word. Warbringer has not come back.
Yes, the truce works for both sides, Theron agreed. I keep my word. The ogre narrowed his eyes for a moment, then nodded. If you allow, I must work magic. I need to warn others of the dead warriors, Theron said. The ogre language had no word for undead. With no pause for consideration, the ogre nodded again, granting the request.
Haunu chixixia, gefetio delu, Theron chanted,
then held a finger aloft, and waited until a bird alighted upon it. The little thrush shook its feathers as Theron whispered its message.
Then the bird flew off into the canopy as it began a mission at the magic's compulsion.
Your warning goes, the elder ogre noted. Now it is treaty time. No ogres leave the forest. No humans enter.
Yes, very well, we... Theron's words were lost as the elder ogre's club flattened him to the forest floor. The other four who had survived the reborn dead followed shortly thereafter,
their screams ripped from lungs worn dry by running.
Kyrus opened the door of his bedroom, eyes still gummed with the remnants of sleep, to find one of the palace guards waiting for him. The man had been provided a chair and table from one of the vacant sitting rooms by the look of the upholstery, and he was eating from a tray of tea and pastries. The guard clambered out of his chair, transferring a half-eaten sweet tart to the tray in the process.
Good morning, Sir Brennus.
I suppose that was my morning feast you were enjoying a moment ago? Kyrus asked, arching an eyebrow.
No, sir. I've been here since before dawn, waiting. The kitchen sent this up hours ago. Tea's even cold. Check for yourself.
Kyrus did not reply, but merely waited for the guard to sort himself out. The man was dense as dragon bone, but took the hint eventually.
Oh, the warlock wanted to see you in the map rune, soon as you were up, which you are now.
Kyrus eyed the man crossways.
Too little sleep, I suppose.
Warlock Rashan, what was his mood like when you last saw him?
Fine spirits, sir. You might even call him giddy.
Kyrus stole a scone and a cup of cold tea, eating the latter as he walked.
Giddy? Oh, that bodes ill.
For a man whose hobbies involved blood and the sacking of cities, giddiness was hardly a cause for comfort.
Azat probably decided to invade us. No one else seems keen on fighting anymore.
Of course, Kairos knew that was not entirely true. Jinzan Fair was taking on the role of Lorimar and hero to all that opposed Kadrin. Likely, Rishan had some news along that vein. The echoes down the corridor in front of Kairos struck a familiar chord in Kairos's mind as he drew nearer his destination. Rishan's singing voice was reedy, but it was clearly the noise he heard ahead of him. He had the melody chained to a wall, flogging it. The poor thing was in audible agony, but the tune was familiar. The words fit uncomfortably, the Kadrin syllables wedged in where accordion ones had been scooped out. But it was an old tune that Kairos knew. It was the sort of song the Greybeards dredged out of the bottom of their fourth tankard of ale or so, making ridiculous boasts of prowess on subjects martial, marital, and everywhere in between, growing wilder by the verse. It was inappropriate fare in taverns before a certain late hour, wildly so in the Imperial Palace. Of course, who was going to tell that to the demon? "Has anyone ever told you that you cannot sing?" Kairos asked upon reaching the doorway. The song stopped. "No one who's lived to tell the tale," Rishan replied, and fixed Kairos with a smile fit to swindle a money changer.
"Well, let me be the first, then. You cannot."
"First time for everything, I suppose," Rishan replied. "Such as me besting you at your little game of predicting enemy movements."
"Ah, is that the byword this morning? The reason the guard outside my door told me that you were giddy? I would have thought a few hundred winters of being right ought to have inured you to such gloating."
"You might think so, but no," Rishan said. "You can impress most of the folk around here by doing sums without consulting your fingers. I've bested simpletons and the creatively stunted. I had a conspiracy sniffed out right beneath my nose."
And little Celia Mistfield peels back a layer to show me that my most trusted bootlick was masterminding it.
"I spent most of a season assuming that Jinzan Fair must have taken refuge in Azat, or taken his chances in the jungles of Elok, where I might never find him. Instead, I discover he was foolish enough to be lurking beneath Gelk, in tombs I had thought burned and buried. I had a special doom planned for my old Gelkin friends, and I still might visit it upon them, but in the meanwhile, I wait and deal with the latest necromancer to think himself a threat to the Empire."
"Is he not a threat to the Empire?" Kairos asked.
He had wandered into the room and began looking at the illusory map, seeking changes that had been made since he last saw it. "No, not really. Oh, the people within it, certainly, but not the Empire itself. The Empire will endure. The day he manages to kill the two of us, then perhaps the Empire will be imperiled. But until such time, he's a fly. We might swat in vain at him, but eventually he will land long enough for us to smash him to ruin. And I was the one who guessed his path." Rishan crossed his arms and nodded to the map. As Kairos watched, the city of Wyselton caught fire. A tiny plume of smoke rose to knee-height above it.
"This makes you happy?" Kairos asked, pointing to the little fire. He hoped that his tone came across curious, rather than accusatory. There was little point antagonizing the warlock.
"No, of course not. It makes me right. Which is, well, all right, fine, maybe a bit," Rishan replied. He made an effort to suppress his smile, but gave it up. He grinned like a drunken wine steward.
"So why are you still here, then?" Kairos asked. "I would have thought you'd have set out at once and have Jinzan Fair's head in a hand when I saw you next."
"Where would I go? Even speeded by the ether, this bird might have been a day, 2 days, half a 10 day in flight," Rishan said, lifting his palms overhead and letting them fall. "We need to decide where to head him off."
"Depends on the speed of the bird," Kairos said. "Sharefield, Dolok, Garsley. Any could have been sacked by now, or under siege as we speak."
"Seems that way. What say we each pick a city and go see for ourselves?" Rishan suggested.
"Did you not say that chasing behind him was a fool's game?" Kairos asked in reply.
"Perhaps, perhaps. But where would you pick if you had your wager?"
"Garsley," Kairos stated. His red line tracing the route from Lon Mai through Reaver's Crossing
and into the heart of the Empire wavered and squirmed. From Reaver's Crossing, it diverted northwest to Wiselton, then swerved south to Garsley.
"Is this to vex me?" Rashan snapped. "Clearly he has turned his attentions westward. Why would he change course again?"
"A few reasons that I can think of. He could be sweeping up all our northern cities to build his forces. He could be practicing his craft before confronting a real opposition. Or maybe he's just trying to match wits with you and guess where you would not," Kyra said.
Then turned away from Rashan and shrugged.
"Or for all I know, he ventured into the Ogre Lands to field an army of the brutes. That might be entertaining. I never bothered much with ogres. I cannot say I ever had cause to fight one, dead or alive," Rashan mused. "Fine for you, maybe, but I had my fill," said Kyrus, turning to face Rashan again. "My last assignment before Kelvi Forest was pushing the ogres back deeper into their territory. They had been raiding Wiselton, Donald's fort, and the surrounding countryside. I would sooner not face them again."
"You are not the Brennus you used to be. I doubt they are much of a threat to you now," Rashan observed. "Or had you forgotten? Does this feel so much like home now?"
Kyrus drew a quick breath and looked around to be certain no one was near. It was a reflexive action. His dual ether vision had already told him as much. As his conscious mind caught up and realized no one was around to hear, he nodded. "I imagine it was much the same for Aga long ago," Kyrus replied. The demon's eyes shot wide and stared. Kyrus replied with a knowing smile. "You enjoy killing, and you like toying with minds," Kyrus said. "My hobbies have always been books and studying. I've grown quite good at digging up old facts."
"Well played, Brannis, well played," Rashan said, regaining himself.
The warlock nodded in acknowledgement. "There is not a man alive who knew Aga save for me. I know not what scrap of moldering paper put that name and mine together for you, but I will not insult you by denying it."
"Birth records," Kyrus lied. "Whatever you did to keep yourself a secret, you left that much behind. It got me a small list that I referenced against Akkadian documents from the time period of your disappearance. Aga might well have been your own great-great-grandsire for all anyone knew, and still have been just a relic with the same name. No one lives to 140, except Aga."
"I suppose I told you too much of myself to expect you not to solve that little riddle," Rashan said. "I suppose we can wait another day on the necromancer hunt. I've sent birds off to warn the cities along Jinzan Fair's path, except for Mune and Whitefield. I've been in touch with those by speaking stone. I despise waiting, but you may be right. That is why I keep you around, to be right."
Rashan looked down, as if lost in thought, pondering Coria's expanse.
"Even when you dislike the answers?" Kyrus asked.
Rashan's head popped up, a shrewd look in his eye. "Especially when I dislike the answers."
"It wasn't what I was expecting, that's all," Kyrus said. He was slouched across a chair opposite Axterion's desk. "I let slip a detail I'd been withholding from him, and he seemed to congratulate me for it."
"Mind yourself with Rashan," Axterion replied. "He's the sort who'd bring a knife along to a battle of wits, in case he needed to even the odds."
He seemed to welcome it. I almost begin to wonder whether I can check his impulses, make him more used to the Empire than a detriment, Kyrus mused aloud, looking off into some convenient corner of the library for his eyes to settle.
"Rethinking your vengeance?"
Axterion inquired.
"You wouldn't be the first, of course, but it's usually age that gets it out of most folk, and you haven't got any."
"I could. Life extension is as easy as walking or speaking. Now that I know it, it seems silly not to know how," Kyrus replied. "I think I might even be able to get him to confide the secret of immortality one day."
"And Iridan? Brush those peas under the edge of your plate and forget them there?"
"Have I been unfair to him about that?" Kyrus asked. He pushed Iridan, between he and Juliana pushed him to his death. But Iridan met his end at Magrin Hands, not Rashan's.
"I'm beginning to think I may even know who was wielding the blade that slew him.
It would be unjust to focus my anger at Rashaan in light of that, wouldn't it?
Vengeance isn't about justice. It's about feeling better after losing someone. Gives you something to do, even when there's really nothing you can do. Only works until you get it. A better journey than destination, said Axterion. Oh, and brush that immortality rubbish right out of your empty skull.
Didn't you read that book about Talax?
Kyrus nodded.
Well, think on that for a while before you spend a few hundred winters driving yourself mad.
But my hobbies really are just old books and studying. I've grown quite good at digging up old facts, and that sounds like a really wonderful one to know, even if I never use the knowledge.
Kyrus tried to tell himself that he could resist the urge if he did know.
Rashaan must have a weakness, and knowing how he was made might also tell me how he could be unmade.
Yes, that was the line of argument he would use against himself,